Hello, folks. This is Micah Redding here. Over the next few episodes, we're going to be doing something a little different. We're kicking off a series on spirituality and the singularity. And what we're trying to do is to get some unique perspectives from some different voices about how spirituality has affected and has been affected by their perspectives on the singularity. And what we hope to do with this is to really kind of dig into some issues that haven't really been explored very widely within the singularity and transhumanist communities, and maybe deal with some issues that people in the broader world might be dealing with as we kind of move into this future of accelerating change. So our first interview is with Mike Morrell, and he's very involved with the Christian world, and I'll let him kind of explain more about who he is and where he comes from. But we hope you enjoy this series, and if you have any feedback, we'd love to hear it. Brickcaster.com/singularity. Enjoy.
I'm here with Mike Morrell, and tell us just a little bit about who you are, about what our listeners need to know about you.
Sure. Well, Mike, it's great to be on with you today. My name is Mike Morrell, and I am a freelance publicist. I work with publishers and authors who are doing all kinds of interesting things, as well as with events, most notably the Wild Goose Festival, which is a justice, arts, and spirituality festival that happens annually in North Carolina. It will be coming up this June 21st through 24th at Shikori Hills in North Carolina. I also, and I'm presuming one of the reasons why we're chatting today, is I am allegedly a student in the MSF program at Regent University in Strategic Foresight. I say allegedly because I'm on a bit of a hiatus right now. Jay, if you're listening, I owe you an email. But I'm very interested in the future of everything, and it's really fascinating how much we can know about the future, both on a quantitative level of just looking at where the data is pointing us, as well as on a more intuitive or qualitative level of looking at where our imagination is pointing us.
And you're pretty involved in the religious and spiritual world. Can you tell me a little bit about your religious background, kind of where you're coming from?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, you know, I grew up kind of a denominational mutt. I had a coming to faith experience, and in my case, Christian faith, as a kid in the Southern Baptist Church as a four-year-old. I think it was Sunday school class. And so we were there for a number of years. And then my parents, and then later I, had an experience that we consider to be a baptism in the Holy Spirit, which is, you know, this kind of spiritual ecstatic experience that's well known in the Pentecostal and charismatic world. And so we spent a number of years in an independent charismatic church as well as an Assemblies of God congregation. And then for no apparent reason, except for some friendships that were built, ended up being a part of a PCA Presbyterian church for several years. That was, I think, an arts connection. I was involved in an arts camp in high school that led me there. And I guess seeing those different contrasting religious views in some ways impressed me with all of them. In other ways, made me sick of all of them. And so I spent about a decade in this kind of post-denominational Wild West of house churches, or I think as they're known a little bit more these days, organic churches, kind of meeting in a decentralized fashion, no clergy, open participatory gatherings, everyone take direction, you know, take responsibility for the direction of the community. And so I lived in one of those in the Atlanta area, and that eventually brought us to Raleigh, where we moved and were a part of a brief, glorious expression of that with some college friends that, you know, like many things that college friends start, fizzled out. And, yeah, in more recent years, I've been involved, I guess, with what's known as emerging churches. There's a small faith collective called Trinity's Place here in Raleigh that I'm involved with. It's associated with the Alliance of Baptists, which is a progressive Baptist denomination. So in some ways, I'm full circle on the Baptist front, as well as an organization called Presence, which is how you and I know each other. And I like to describe Presence as a kind of eschatological think tank. They're reimagining the popular stories that the Judeo-Christian tradition tells itself about the end times and about the end of reality, and using good biblical scholarship as well as just good imagination, have managed to tell a different story about what the biblical story depicts. And that different story is more of an open participatory future that we co-create with God. And that ends up changing a lot of theology and a lot of implications for things. So I've been privileged to work with Presence for several years now in their endeavors.
How did you first kind of encounter the concept of the singularity? Was that in your future studies, or had you encountered it before that?
Yeah, you know, I think that I first heard the term the singularity either in Ray Kurzweil's The Age of Spiritual Machines, or, of course, his Singularity is Near. I remember one time, you know, wandering through a Barnes & Noble. When the book came out, probably when The Singularity is Near came out, probably around 2005 or so, I was meeting a friend there for coffee. But before she arrived, I was going through the shelves just trying to see what looked interesting. It was like the size of a phone book, and I started skimming it, and I realized, huh, I've got to get this thing. And, you know, once I bought it, it was like, I think I understood the first 50 pages of it, and the rest of it is like mathematical equations. But, you know, the premise really struck me that, you know, we're fast reaching an age where the human brain will be fully mapped out, just like the human genome was mapped out. And when that happens, we will be able to have truly functional artificial intelligence. And when that happens, machines will begin to develop the next generation of machines, creating what would be, to our sort of linear minds, a near vertical wall of innovation. So if we've been sort of trucking along with a huge uptick in the 20th century, and an even larger uptick in the 21st century, even though we're only, you know, a decade or so into it, that this is going to look like nothing we've seen before, and suddenly the wildest science fiction fantasies will be reality. And at least that's, you know, Kurzweil's very enthusiastic, seeing almost no downsides to it, depiction of the singularity.
Yeah. So when you, you know, encountered this idea of, you know, spiritual machines or artificial intelligence, you know, how did that, how did that affect your religious viewpoint, or how did that seem to you? Because, you know, that's a big thing for a lot of religious people and a lot of spiritual people, is that, you know, we are unique in our, you know, certain capabilities, or having a soul or something like that, you know. So how did that strike you?
Yeah, you know, I think that I have been an oddball from the beginning, so it didn't strike me the way it does strike many of my co-religionists. You know, I've grown up on comic books and science fiction, and comics and science fiction deal with the fantastic and the extraordinary all the time. And especially in high school, I was a huge conspiracy and UFO geek. So I read up on alien abductions and so many things that are threatening to sort of a closed system religious worldview that says we figured it all out in our ancient texts thousands of years ago in a way that has sort of solidified, and that we have no further room for insider understanding in our inspired texts. So, yeah. I mean, you know, recently I've actually been doing some significant personal work, and I've rediscovered in my own memory of how even the metaphor of being an alien has resonated with me in my life. When I was a kid, I actually told an antique lady that my mom sold Avon to that I'd come from another planet of shapeshifters, and I had this whole elaborate story about their civilization and why I came to Earth, and at the end of it, she believed me. She said, she looked right at my mom and said, "I think he's telling the truth." So I think there's always been a tension, of course, because religion can either be conservative in an etymological sense of conserving the best of the past, or it can be a driver for change. It could be if you have sort of a future anchoring of what, you know, utopian visions, which a lot of religions offer us in their prophetic writings, that can be an anchor and driver for change. And so I think, honestly, the challenge for religious folk, if anything like the singularity is even remotely true, is to begin to see our uniqueness in a different way. That what does it mean to bear the Imago Dei? What does it mean to bear the image of God? And need that be a limited resource commodity? Or could it be ubiquitous and spread through a variety of different kinds of intelligences and still be a cohesive idea and a unifying force?
That's really intriguing. One thing that that does seem to be a pattern among people who, you know, who kind of are talking about the singularity is that there's you know, some kind of interest in science fiction or fantasy that kind of created a broader palette of possibilities, I guess, to, you know, to consider. From early on, opened up kind of just the ability to contemplate and be comfortable with a lot of different ideas of reality. And that's something I seem to see in a lot of people. So that is really interesting. With looking forward at the future, do you see that, you kind of mentioned, maybe there are some, some downsides. Are you an optimist or a pessimist or what? How do you look at the short term, near term, 50, 100 years out,
Yeah.
What do you think of?
Yeah, well, I'm not specialized enough to argue with Kurzweil one way or another in terms of the technical aspect of his predictions. And I know that there are experts who dispute him as well as experts who corroborate his timeline for, when will we have the brain mapped out? When will we have truly functional AI that will give birth to all of this? I really can't speak to that on an expert level. What I can wonder about is whether or not we as a civilization will even last that long to be able to sustain that kind of technology. Jeremy Rifkin wrote a really interesting book a couple years ago called The Empathic Civilization, The Race to Global Consciousness in a World of Crisis. And his thesis is that at least for the last 10,000 or so years, since the agrarian revolution or the agrarian de-evolution, depending on how you see our ability to farm and giving up the hunter-gatherer lifestyle, that since then, initially we were in sort of, whatever it was that Hobbes said about life being poor, nasty, brutish, and short, every person for himself, this sort of, melee of carnage and self-interested, kind of a libertarian's dream of how the world works. but he said that with every successive increase in advancement in technology, it has also increased our empathy. So with certain tools like the printing press, we suddenly were able to feel with a larger group of people. And so he talks about the move to, how does he put it? I'm just going to look here in the table of contents as I have it right here. developmental theorists like integralists like Ken Wilber and others who have synthesized the developmental theories of people like Claire Graves and Carol Gilligan would say that the human beings as well as civilizations move through being me-centric to then being my family-centric to being my tribe-centric, and then with certain contemporary innovations that started like 500-600 years ago, you suddenly started having nationalistic consciousness and what Rifkin calls theological consciousness, to where, when we look back on it now, we might say, oh gosh, the Christians and the Muslims were killing each other. Isn't that awful? But what he's saying is, if you look at it forward as the forward momentum of progress, the fact that there was even a group of people that lived in geographically disparate places that called themselves Christians or called themselves Muslims was an increase in empathy that was spurred on by technological innovation. And yes, it was still tribalistic in the sense that it still pitted us against them, but that technological innovations that are happening now, like the airplane and now the computer, are all bringing us to a point of almost total empathy saturation. Now, if you read comments on YouTube and the Huffington Post, you might not think the technology is doing that at all. But I do think...
Right, that's a big counter-argument.
Yes, it is. Because but that's actually part of the growing pains, I think, because it's throwing people of wildly different worldviews to a red state, blue state, urban, rural, who would have never spoken to each other in the past. Suddenly they're all on the same website, and all the stuff is being stirred up in them, especially the least emotionally developed amongst all of us. But Rifkin's feeling is that as soon as we have empathy for all of the human, well, let me back up. There's a downside, too. Because each increase in technology that increases empathy also increases entropy, because each new technology puts a huge new strain on the environment and on our ecology. So when we have these innovations taking place, you know, suddenly we have an airplane, which is great socially speaking, because now I can hop on a plane, if I'm wealthy enough, that is, and I can see someone in another part of the world, and I can have this total eat, pray, love moment where I'm like, wow, people in, you know, Sri Lanka are amazing. And used to, if my country said I was going to go to war with Sri Lanka, I'd be like, well, yeah, let's kill the bastards. But now I've, you know, had a meditation class in Sri Lanka, and I don't want to kill those people.
Yeah.
So that's a good thing. That's a social good, and that's an empathy thing. But the amount of jet fuel that it takes to get there is an entropy thing. And so now that we have all these buzzing computers and phones in our pockets and all this technology that Kurzweil thinks is great and amazing, Rifkin says we're in danger of tapping out our resources before we reach what he calls peak empathy. And peak empathy would be where we have enough empathy not only for our fellow humans, but even the non-human population, to where our very love and connectedness and empathy drives innovation to the point where we create a clean energy source or a renewable energy source or Nikola Tesla's free energy. It's not incompatible with Kurzweil's vision, because I think that Kurzweil would probably say that nanotechnology is going to save the world, that once we are able to create, you know, anything out of anything, we can spin dirt into gold, the alchemist's dream will be realized, and wealth will be relativized. There will no longer be poverty or riches, and we can all have abundance, we can all have what we want. Even the more depraved minds among us can be hooked up to virtual reality and not be harming others while living out our crazy fantasies or whatever. These visions are compatible, but Rifkin does point to a very real possibility that we could reach peak entropy before we reach peak empathy. And if that happens, and I do think that there are signs that that could be, that is a probable future, with sort of geopolitical tensions and ecological degradation, that we might actually collapse before we reach the ability to fully map out the brain and do what needs to be done for the singularity to take place.
That's an interesting thing, and a lot of conversations I've been in recently. There's that sort of idea, and sometimes it's not necessarily empathy versus entropy. It might be other things, you know, our ability to defend ourselves versus our ability to harm other people, you know. But there's like this race between two different or you know multiple different things as to what determines the ultimate future, you know.
Yeah.
And that is a really, really, I guess, important thing to think deeply about and try to figure out where we want to kind of throw our weight around you know, as we go into that.
And so, people of faith have, you know, a huge crossroads, because we can either try to bury our heads in the sand and pretend that this stuff isn't happening, pretend that the innovation is not reaching this point, pretend that we're not in a race between empathy and entropy or these other indicators that we're observing. Or we can really dig deep into our traditions and kind of compost them in unique ways, because in some ways they're just outdated. In some ways they're dying, and there's nothing we can do about that. Everything arises in a moment in time that serves us. Think of the Axial Age when, you know, Buddha and Confucius and the Hebrew prophets and so many others rose up. It was like a renaissance. Their faith was like 100% relevant to the age in which they emerged. Now we're in a place where parts of our faith do indeed still seem to be relevant, but other parts seem to be completely irrelevant. And we end up polarizing between, I think, like atheists who say, chuck it all out, and fundamentalists who say, no, we want to practice our faith as we did in 1687. But if our faith is decaying and dying, then we can compost it. And out of the stench and ferment of the decay, new soil can be created, that the new life of spirit can bring something else out of it that will owe a debt of gratitude to what has come before. And I don't know, to me that just seems like a scenario in which we could all be happy, but it's rarely that simple.
So that's, I guess that's my kind of final question for you is, you know, over the next several decades, as, you know, as we go into this sort of dramatically accelerating change, and then beyond that, how do you see spirituality changing? How do you see that, you know, taking into account the new things in the world or the new dynamics in the world? You know, I don't know, what is your kind of big picture vision there?
Yeah. You know, it's such a good question. And I think that the maybe safest thing to say is that there is no one singular religious future, that the future of religion is, I think, radical plurality, radical pluralism. We have, you know, at least if we don't reach the sort of peak entropy, we do have the resources at our fingertips to really do whatever we want in terms of either a solo spiritual path or a faith community. You know, with the internet, we have access to the world's religious treasures at our fingertips. But this landmark study was just published maybe about a year and a half ago called American Grace, How Religion Divides and Unites Us. And Putnam and Campbell, who did the research, discovered that younger people in particular are tired of the culture wars. They're tired of the politicizing of faith, but they're not tired of faith necessarily. They're just looking for new wineskins, to use a Christian metaphor. And so, I don't know, I think I could be as guilty of confirmation bias as anyone, but I do think that my experiences in the last 15 years have taught me that I think religion is going to come into the hands of amateurs rather than professionals. You know, the root etymology of amateur means lover. And I think that religion done by people for the love of it and who are creating what they want to see and are being open to the leadings of God, of spirit, of the transcendent, I think that that is the future. And then these communities will probably be smaller than churches and mosques and synagogues that we've known in the past. They will but they'll be more flexible and more adaptive. And the people who are involved in them, you know, might be kind of social innovators. They might not be the general population. And that is one of the downsides of it, is sort of a lack or a loss of Catholicity in the lowercase C Catholic sense, of church in a town square where you're sort of forced to encounter a wide variety of people because you're all worshiping there because you're, you know, you're Catholic or you're Muslim or whatever. It is sort of a nicheification and specialization of faith that seems like is emerging. But amongst those who are involved in it, I think they'll be smart. They're not just going to kind of cafeteria-style pick and choose, but they will carefully reflect on their tradition, you know, for Christians, the Bible and church history or what have you, and draw out those practices that speak best to our situation and that hopefully will help us be intelligent human beings to navigate the big changes that are probably on the horizon with things like the singularity.
Yeah, that's you've got a very broad vision there. So that's thanks for kind of giving us from, you know, from the dawn of time to our future. So you got the whole spectrum. So
I try to be positive,
Micah. That's right. Yeah. So, but yeah, I think this has been very, you know, very helpful. Hopefully for you know, getting some different insight on that. So
absolutely,
thank you,
Micah.
Yeah,
and thank you for having me on. I appreciate your work and all the blogging that you're doing these days. You're raising exact right questions, and you know, hanging out with Mormon transhumanists and everyone else you're doing some stuff with is great. I'm really enjoying being along for the ride.
Got to keep, you know, stirring the pot. So all right. So well, thank you very much, and we'll talk to you later.
Okay, thank you.